to honor, to cherish, to have and to hold in richer and poorer, in sickness and in health, until death do us part. What could be more beautiful than the sight of a couple standing at the altar holding hands and reciting these vows to one another, promising and pledging a love that they have? And as the preacher says these words, they look into one another's eyes, possibly tears starting to form, a little giddy feeling. Maybe the butterflies are flying just out of formation right now. And then they utter those words, those beautiful words, "I do." Well, I do what? You know, we say it all the time. I'm convinced that last week there were thousands of people that got married. Thousands of people said, "I do." And thousands of people have no idea in the world what they were saying when they said those words. When these promises are made, there are certain obligations that go along with the words, "I do." Things like duty. Things like dependence on one another. We are not islands. Things about a debt to one another. What I owe this person and this person owes me. There's a desire formed between these two people. Now, I tried to convince Rick to let me do this one at the 10 o'clock hour when the women were out there. But he wouldn't let me do it. He said there's no good if they're going to be out there. They need to be in here. And I don't know if he meant his wife personally or women in general. But maybe Lee can take that up with him later. When a woman chooses a mate, she is saying to him, promising to him, "I owe you something." And when a man chooses a woman, he is saying to her, when he agrees to get married, that he is going to be indebted to her and owe her something. A woman owes her husband something that she owes no other man in this world. And a husband likewise owes something to his wife that he owes no other woman. And let me say something about this relationship for just a moment. This is not only the building block for the family, which, brethren, it is. The family relation, the marriage relationship, becomes the building block upon which children will come into the relationship, upon which they will become mothers and fathers, and they will become grandparents, and hopefully they will have a long line of people behind them that are building a family after family after family, but it begins with this marriage. But not only is it the building block for the marriage, brethren, and I think this is one of the greatest things about this lectureship, is the home is the building block for the church. You know why I say that? Look at how many times the church is depicted as a family, as a home, as the married relationship. And if we can't get it right in the home, brethren, how are we going to get it right in the church? That's why it's important to talk about the home and about the relationships that we have one with another. And in this particular case, the relationship of the husband and the wife. And so we ask that question, the question that needs to be asked time and time again. Not just from this direction, but Rob Whitaker, he's going to save my hide and come in and talk about husbands hopefully tomorrow. But today I'm going to talk just about the wives. What does a wife owe to her husband? And we're going to take this from 1 Peter chapter 3. So I would encourage you to turn to 1 Peter chapter 3 as we identify five things that a woman owes her husband. That is submission, example, attractiveness, meekness, and respect. I'm done, Tim. We're going to take these five passages or five ideas from 1 Peter. Submission is what a wife must submit to the authority of their husbands. Every wife must do this. Let's begin in verse 1. Likewise, you wives be in subjection unto your own husbands. So we go back and we see the word likewise. The idea here that he's bringing up is that he's going back to chapter 2. In chapter 2, he's dealing with the different relationships that we have in the church. And he says about those relationships, for example, the Christian's relationship to the government. He says that you are to be subjected to the government, the laws of the land. He deals with the master-slave relationship. That the master is one over a slave. The slave has a requirement from the hand of God to submit to the master as well. And likewise, he comes down and he's talking about wives. So he's dealt with Christians in the government, he's dealt with master slaves, and now he's dealing with, specifically, husbands and wives. And he begins, I believe, talking to the wives. And he tells her that she needs to be in submission. Now notice this, to your own husband, to your own. You know what those two words signify? Ownership. Do you realize when a man says to a woman, I want you to be my wife, and she agrees and says, yes, I want you to be my husband, that essentially they're saying we want to own one another? In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 4, it says that the woman does not have power over her body, but the husband. Likewise also, the husband does not have power over his body, but the wife. That is, that there is a certain amount of ownership that goes into the marriage relationship. And the first thing that the woman has to recognize is that there is submission here. And notice, one other word in this context is the idea of husband. Husband. We're talking about the husband-wife relationship, not the boyfriend-girlfriend relationship. Too many times we see young men in the church trying to lead young women around as if they are already married, and they're destroying a relationship before they ever get it built. It does not say here that she owes her boyfriend anything, but rather that she owes her husband a certain amount of subjection. And so we see the idea of subjection comes from the word hupotasso. Wonderful little word here, isn't it? According to Kittle's Theological Dictionary, the New Testament, he says that this word is coming in the middle voice, which is used with the passive aorist. And as much Greek as I got in this school, I couldn't tell you what in the world that means. So I've got to read this book to find out. But it means this. It means that there is a voluntary submission with the idea of having the power to do otherwise. Now think about that for just a moment. A woman willingly submits to her husband. Not because he is all powerful, not because he has a certain amount of power that she does not have, not because he has more wisdom than she has, not for any other reason than God said so. Because a woman submits voluntarily despite her power to do so. One other place where this particular word is used comes in Luke chapter 2 and verse 5. Here Jesus has been with his parents and they've gone to Jerusalem. They're worshiping in the temple and they leave. It's time to go home. So they're trucking back to Nazareth and they look inside the caravan and lo and behold, Jesus is not there. Their 12-year-old son is lost, and you can just imagine the frantic cries of mother. Where is my son? Where is my son? As they turn the caravan around and they go back to Jerusalem to look for him. And they get there and they find him in the temple, discussing things of deep theological significance with the Pharisees and the doctors of the law, the rulers, and the priests. Jesus, why did you stay behind? And you remember what Jesus told his mother? Got to be about my father's business. Even at age 12, he had a power and authority inside of him. By the spirit that he possessed, by his own spirit, being the spirit of God, he had a power and authority that he could dispute with the doctors of the law. And yet notice what it says in verse 52, he went down with his parents and was back, or going back to Nazareth, and was, get this, submissive to them. Very same word that is used in 1 Peter chapter 3 and verse 1. In describing the wife's relationship to the husband, we see that there is a certain parallel then between the husband-wife relationship and the relationship of Jesus and his parents. You see, Jesus willingly submitted to his parents. He didn't have to. I mean, he is God incarnate. He is divine or divinity right here on earth. He had the power within him to rule the world, even those days. And yet he willingly submitted to his parents despite his power to do otherwise. Women, wives willingly submit to their husbands despite a power, a wisdom, an experience, whatever you want to call it, to do otherwise. The idea that people are coming up with saying, well, that's just Paul. That's one of the reasons why I chose Peter's arguments in chapter 1 Peter 3 as opposed to Paul's definition of marriage in Ephesians 5. Because a lot of people get down on Paul. Well, Paul was just a chauvinist. Paul was, didn't like me. He was insecure as a man himself. That's why he believed these things, right? No. It's because he was inspired of God to write these things down. And this is God's design. And Peter says it just like Paul said it. In fact, Paul said it in Ephesians chapter 5 and verse 22. Wives, submit yourselves unto your husband as to the Lord. In the same way that we today submit to God, to His authority, in order to become Christians. Think about this for just a moment. God does not come down on us and say, okay, you have got to submit. And by gunpoint, take us to the waters of baptism, does He? He doesn't use a sword. He doesn't use a knife. He doesn't abuse us and browbeat us into the water. He says, look, here is my love for you. Here is the grace that I offer you. And He beseeches us. He begs us. He pleads with us through His grace and His love that we might submit to Him willingly. And those who are willing to accept, they follow along, they submit, and they become children of God. In the same tender way, God pleads with women to do the same thing to their husbands. Submit, be in subjection to, not because she's inferior, but because someone has to be the head. It's that simple. One of the ugliest things I've ever seen is for a husband to browbeat, abuse, torture, and torment his wife into subjection. I'll recall, I couldn't have been more than 18, maybe 19 years old. And I was in a van, and there were probably 10 to 15 people in this van, and there was one man who was sitting in the front passenger seat, and his wife was sitting near toward the back, and they began arguing over a certain thing that was going on. I believe we were listening to a song on the radio, and I don't think she liked the actual song and was kind of complaining about it, and they kind of bantered back and forth, and you could tell it was starting to escalate a little bit, and she started raising her voice, and he started raising her voice. And in front of these 10 people, at least 10 people, he turned to her and he said, "Woman," actually addressed her by name, but I'm not going to say that, "get in subjection." And embarrassed her, brought her to tears, embarrassed everyone in the van. It is not the husband's place to make the wife submit. It's God's place. He made the law, and it's His place to have her submit. And if He says, do so as unto the Lord, He's saying, by His love and His grace and His caring and His protection and providing for His people, He is drawing people in through willing submission. And I will say this about husbands. I know this is not my job, but about husbands, through your love and your protection and your care and your respect of your wife, you will draw her to submission. It doesn't take the back of your hand. It doesn't take the rule of thumb. It doesn't take verbal abuse. It doesn't take mental anguish. It takes your love, and a woman will willingly, I promise, willingly submit to a husband who is of that character and that stature. There is no doubt about it. As we go to the Scriptures, as we look at what the Bible says, that a wife owes her husband subjection. But secondly, a wife owes her husband an example. He goes on in verse 1 and he says that if any obey not the word, they may also, without the word, be won by the conversation of the wives. While beholding her your chaste conversation coupled with fear. That is, God is looking down, or the man is looking at his wife. He sees her conduct. He sees that she has this pure conduct, and he wants to be a part of that. He is being converted simply by, get this, the example of his wife. He reflects upon the possibility of a believing wife actually converting an unbelieving or infidel husband. In 1 Corinthians chapter 7 and verse 16, where it's talking about the marriage relationship and the unbelieving depart, and he says she is no longer under bondage to follow after him, or she is not under bondage, literally not ever under that type of bondage, as a slave to follow after him in his sin and run after him in that case. But it goes on in verse 16 and it says, "For who knows that she might not convert her husband if she stays a Christian? Who knows that if she's the one that's the unbeliever and he stays a Christian, that he might also convert her? That's exactly what Peter is saying here. But let me say something real quickly. Peter is not saying that with certainty you are going to convert your spouse simply through your chaste conversation or by your example. In fact, notice the words that he says. They also may, not definitely, not shall, but may. There's a possibility. There's only one absolute that I see in this passage. While you may not convert your husband, it is absolutely certain, wives, if you don't set an example of righteousness before your husband, if you go around claiming to be a Christian and you attend services, Bible class on Sunday morning and worship services on Sunday morning, go again on Sunday evening and Wednesday evening, and the rest of the time when you're around your husband who's a non-believer, you act just like he does from the world, there is an absolute certainty you will never, ever convert him. That's the only absolute in that passage. That's why it's so imperative that you don't give in. And even if it is that he is a Christian, you still set the example. But notice this. Where does she set the example? She sets the example first, I believe, as a Christian. Park your finger for just a moment in 1 Peter 3 and turn over to Titus chapter 2. Titus chapter 2 offers a wonderful example of how women are to be examples. In Titus chapter 2, beginning in verse 3, he says, "The aged women, likewise, that they be in behavior that becomes holiness, not false accusers, not given to much wine, teachers of good things." Skip just a little bit here. "They are to be sober, to be discreet, chaste, and good." What does that describe to you? One who is reverent, one who is not a slanderer, one who is not an alcoholic, one who is in self-control, one that is pure, one that is kind. I submit to you that describes a Christian. What he is telling the older women is that they teach the younger women to be an example of Christ on this earth. Why? Well, Peter answers the question. Because without the word, she may be able to convert her unbelieving husband. But even if he is a believer, she can help strengthen him through her example. And so, the Christian woman, who are the wife, who owes it to her husband to be an example of a Christian. But secondly, she also owes it to be an example as a spouse. What are her obligations or his obligations as a spouse? If a woman looks at the obligations that are put upon her as a spouse and says no to him, how can she expect a husband to look at his obligations and say yes to him? Going back to Titus chapter 2, again, they are to train the younger women to, number one, love their husbands, and number two, to be submissive to their own husbands. She is to be an example of what it means to obey God's design in the spousal relationship, to love her husband and to be submissive to her husband. But thirdly, I see not only is she an example of a Christian and of a spouse, but also as a parent. When he says that she is to be an example, she is to be an example as a parent. Again, going back and finishing up our text in Titus chapter 2, the older women are training the younger women to love their children, to be working at home. She's setting the example of righteousness in the home, even toward her own children, training them up in the way that they should go, in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord, teaching them, training them, singing with them, praying with them. She is setting the example of what a parent must do for their children. Not alone, but it is nonetheless her job to take part in raising the parent or raising the children. Train the young women to love their children. It's almost sad that he even has to mention it, isn't it? You would think that a woman who decides to have children and her husband together, they're going to have children. You would think that based upon that decision, they already love the idea of having children, right? They love the children that are going to be born to them, but that's not true. There are parents who show a certain amount of abuse and hatred toward their children by farming them off to others, by giving them to people who are not teaching them in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. But notice what he says. The obligation is you have got to train your children. Love them. train them, bring them up in the nurture and the admonition of the Lord. And be keepers at home. Well, what in the world does that mean? Like one thing Jim Nash said in his lesson this morning, talking about fathers. He was talking about the great responsibility that has been put upon them. And how in the end, if the whole family is unbelieving and drifting from God, not only will each one of them answer individually for their actions, but as the father, it's going to come back on him as well. I think this same thing is put upon women when it comes to their house. Some say, well, that means she's got to stay home and make sure the house is clean. No, it doesn't. Proverbs 31 tells us that that's a lie. Proverbs 31 says that the woman who was virtuous, whose price was far above rubies, went out and saw to her affairs and to her business and to her job, it appears. It did say that she kept the home, though, doesn't it? You don't have to stay at home to keep the home. And I would say this. If a woman wants to work outside the home, and she wants to hire a house cleaner, and they have the money to do so, let them hire a house cleaner. If the woman wants to go out and work, and she wants to help have the kids help clean the house, then I say let her delegate to the children, and even a willing husband. Or if she wants to put her own elbow grease in it when she comes home from work, then let her do that. Because when it comes right down to it, as long as it's getting done, that reflects on her. Of course, the flip side of that, wives, is if you're going to work and you're letting the house run down and fall apart, that also reflects on you. And just like the fathers are going to be held accountable for some things, wives are going to be held accountable for some things. And if it's not getting done, if you've hired a maid and she's not doing the job, it's not her fault. It's yours. So be an example as a parent, keeping the home, the house in tidy order, keeping the children in well-behaved ways, as an example to the husband, I think ultimately to teach the husband as well. Third, though, the wife owes her husband attraction. Attractiveness. Wives must owe a certain personal beauty that when their husbands look at them, they are happy with what they see. In Willard Harley's book, His Needs, Her Needs, he writes about the attractive qualities. In fact, he mentions five things that a husband needs more than anything else. The first one was physical interaction, or what we commonly term as sex. But among the five, get this, he said he needs an attractive mate. And he says, I'm often challenged when I list an attractive mate as one of man's five most basic marital needs. People don't believe him. People even say to him, well, or women come to him and say, well, that's superficial, that's shallow, that's vain. Okay, maybe it is. But there is a certain amount of truth to it. I promise you. Women say, yeah, but, am I supposed to look like Shania Twain? Well, guess what? Your husband didn't look at Shania Twain and fall in love and settle for you. Your husband looked at you and found you beautiful in ways beyond description. And he married you for it. All we mean by attraction is you find those things that your husband likes. If he likes you to wear your hair a certain way, wear it that way. If he likes you in a certain style of clothes, as long as they're modest, wear those clothes. If he likes you with a certain color of lipstick or a certain odor, as Monty says, fragrance through the rest of the world, wear it. But you know, I think most spiritual men are looking for something a little different than this in attractiveness. And I think it's what Peter hits up on. It says, do not let your adorning be what? Outward adorning. Of the plaiting of the hair and of the wearing of gold or of the putting on of apparel, but let it be the hidden man of the heart, which is not corruptible. Beauty in the eyes of those who are spiritual goes far beyond the hair and the depth of their skin. It goes directly into the very heart of the woman. If you want to see a man, and I'm going to use a phrase, and I hope you don't think it's inappropriate, but if you want to see a man who is turned on by his wife. Let her profess Christianity and godliness. Otherwise, he is carnally minded and in spiritual death. Notice what Paul writes in 1 Timothy chapter 2, which I believe is very similar to what Peter is discussing here. Beginning in verse 9, he says, "In like manner also that the women adorn themselves in modest apparel, with shamefacedness and sobriety, not with the broiding of hair, or the braiding of hair, or gold, or pearls, or costly array, but which becomes a woman professing godliness, what? With good works, isn't it? That's what it is. You want to see a beautiful woman? I'll show you a beautiful woman. Her clothes are Christ. The adornment that she has are the ways of God. And she is drawn spiritually first to the Father in heaven and secondly to the spirituality of her husband. A woman owes a certain amount of attractiveness, not just outwardly, but the true attractiveness, attractiveness that comes from the woman that is clothed in godliness. Fourth, we're almost done. Tim's not even up here. Meekness. Wives owe their husbands a quiet and peaceable spirit. In verse 4, he goes on to say that even the adornment of a meek and quiet spirit. Notice he identifies this, first of all, as that which is not corruptible. The meek and quiet spirit is not corruptible. But in the sight of God, get this, is of high value. Prized greatly. Isn't that wonderful? Very precious in the sight of God. And as we look at meekness then, a meek spirit simply identifies that this is a woman who realizes she's got power and yet keeps her power in check. That's what meekness is. We've been taught all of our lives, people like Moses had meekness. That is, he had strength under control. And that's what he's telling wives that they need to have. A woman of meek spirit is a valuable woman. In fact, it says so right here that she has high value or is in the sight of God of a great price. What makes something of high value, do you know? High demand, low supply, isn't it? Men want a woman with a meek spirit. That's a high demand. But you know what? Sadly, it's in low supply. Because this world, from the time that girls are born, are telling them that they have just as much rights and just as much power and just as much authority and strength and everything that the man does. And that her place is equal to or above even as the heads of men. That they have an equal partnership, an equal vote in a marriage relationship, when the Bible so clearly says, wives, be subjective to your own husbands. And women get angry when you start talking about subjection. And I think that's why God said you need to have a meek wife. Because it is the meek wife who says, okay, I have power. I have strength. I have wisdom. But I will keep it in check for the sake of God and be subject to my husband. That's meekness. I believe that's exactly what Peter's talking about here. When he says that she is even has this meek and quiet spirit, which in the sight of God is a great price. Because think about what the alternative is. What's the alternative? Proverbs 25 and verse 24. It is better to live in the corner of a housetop. You find you a shingle and you camp out right there rather than go inside and share it with a brawling woman. That's the alternative. But have you ever wondered why? Why a woman is to be meek and in subjection? I think it's to protect men. You say, wait a minute, Sam. I can take my wife. If you've ever seen my wife, she's a foot shorter than me and well over 100 pounds less than me. I can take my wife down too if I had to. That's not the kind of protection I'm talking about. Because when I say women have power, women have power. Women have a lot of power. And if they abuse that power, guys, we're sunk. And in order to protect us men, I really believe this, he said, find a woman that is meek and submissive for your own good. You watch houses and families, and you've seen them, where the woman is not quite in subjection. Maybe her big toe is under the head of her husband, but it's only because the other foot's on top of his head. She's not in subjection. She's not meek. And we say that family's in trouble. Because she abuses the power that she knows she has. And women, you know you have a power. And she abuses it. God said, you want a happy family, you want the right family, you find a woman who is quiet, meek, and willing to submit. And not abuse the power that women have over men. Well, look at Jesus again as the great example. In Matthew chapter 21, verse 5, as Jesus is coming back into the city of Jerusalem, the triumphal entry. This is the point at which the prophets had prophesied about. Behold, your King is coming to you. We're talking about the one who could have called 10,000 angels. The one who could have brought heaven and earth down on their head. The one who in John chapter 8 and 18 and verse 6, when they asked or they came into the garden, he said, whom do you seek? And they said, Jesus of Nazareth. And Jesus said, I am he. And they fell on their rear ends because of the power that he possessed. That's power. But it says that he came into the city humble. Humble. This is the same word that is used to describe the wife in the meek and quiet spirit. Jesus had power that he kept in submission to himself in order to submit to the very will of God. The woman of a quiet and meek spirit recognizes that power, exercises control over herself to keep it into check, and seeks that quiet and peaceable life that Paul wrote about in 1 Timothy chapter 2. And then finally, a wife owes her husband respect. Reverence, as it says in Ephesians chapter 5, verse 33. But respect, the example is given here of Sarah, who obeyed Abraham, calling him Lord. This was not a term that he was somehow all-powerful, or she thought he was somehow a god, but rather simply a term of respect. She lived a life, or he lived a life that deserved respect from his wife. He was a man who sought the will of God, a man who trusted in the promises God had given, a man who was seeking what was righteousness in this life, and based upon his character, she respected him. She recognized his character and she gave him the respect. Paul writes in Ephesians 5:33, let the wife see that she reverence or respect her husband. But what does it mean for a wife to respect? When a wife respects her husband, that means that she trusts her husband and his ability to provide for the family. And to care for the family, to protect the family. She trusts him. When she doesn't trust those things, she's not giving her husband the proper respect. When a wife respects her husband, she stops nagging him and starts encouraging him. She accepts him for who he is. And her love and respect for him motivates him to be a better husband each and every day. It motivates him to achieve more. When a woman respects her husband, it makes it easier for her husband to love her every time. Going back to his needs, her needs, Willard Harley writes, a woman needs to appreciate her husband for what he already is, not for what he could become if he lived up to her standards. You want to see respect? You watch a wife respect her husband for who he is. And not what she wants him to be. Do we all have a little growing to do? We'd be fools to say we didn't. Not just in the marriage relationship, but in all relationships of this life. But when a woman can look at her husband and respect him for the job he is doing as a husband and as a father,
then they're a lot closer to where they need to be spiritually than they were the day before. And let me just add this real quick. I know, again, I'm not talking about husbands, but guys, if you don't have enough moral character, how can you expect your wife to respect you? I mean, you wouldn't respect a boss who is bankrupt of morals and cheated people. You wouldn't respect a friend. You probably wouldn't hold him as a friend anymore if he was lying all the time to you. And why would we turn around and try to bind upon a woman to respect us when we can't give enough respect for ourselves to stay righteous? It's a very sad thing indeed. After the vows, after the honeymoon, after I do, there are responsibilities. A woman owes it to her husband to be submissive, to be that example of moral courage, to be attractive, to be meek, to be respectful of her husband. You know, sometimes we might ask, where did these come from? It was some insecure man somewhere said that women have to be in subjection, right? No, it was God. God did. God designed these laws. God enforces these laws. And ultimately, God is the one who's going to judge these laws. This is His design for the home. This becomes the building block for the church. We understand it in the church. And we need to understand it in the home. It's not the husband's wife or husband's job to bring his wife into subjection with a rod. It's the husband's design by God to do his part of the family role. Let God judge women based upon what they're doing, not the husband. A gentle reminder may not hurt, but abuse, excessive abuse, simply does not. So it comes down to this. How will you fare in the hands of God and the things that you owe your husbands? I hope that you will fare righteously. Thank you.